So I'm going to present some cases that we saw at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London, who came to see us with fevers. And the first case I'm going to present took part in this eco-challenge expedition, which happens every year apparently, but on this particular year it was in Sabah in Borneo. And it was 2 weeks. There were over 300 athletes from 26 countries, including 22 from the UK. So this is quite a challenging challenge. So they do it in teams of five, teams of four, and they race 300 miles 24 hours a day using kayaks, mountain bikes, whitewater rafts, horses, feet, climbing ropes, and so on, through the jungle. So this man presented to us 3 days after the end of the challenge. He complained of fever, headache, and aches and pains in his muscles. So he had been wading through swamps, he'd been bitten by leeches, mosquitoes, he'd waded through caves full of bats, he'd swum through rivers, he was sleeping rough in the jungle with his teammates, and they'd been foraging for food as they went. The day after he got back, he developed a headache, shivering, rigors, a dry cough. He had a bit of diarrhea just for one day, some abdominal cramps and pains in his muscles, but no other localizing symptoms. On examination, he was obviously a very fit young man. He seemed to have lost weight. He was fully alert. He had a high temperature. He had a fungal rash on his feet, but nothing else abnormal to find. So we had taken a full history. Remember I said yesterday it's important to take a full travel history. He had had no opportunity for having new sexual partners, which was a risk factor we discussed yesterday given the conditions. So he was not at risk for that. So we sent a number of investigations. He had a slight neutrophilia. He had a raised CRP, so raised inflammatory markers, and a slightly raised ESR. His urea and creatinine were just above the upper or around the upper limit of normal, but essentially everything else was within the normal range. So his albumin possibly a little bit low for a very fit young man. Of course, the first investigation in a man with a fever from a malaria endemic area was a malaria film. That was negative. There was a little bit of protein in his urine, but nothing grown from the urine. Blood cultures, no growth. Stool microscopy, we found Diantamoeba fragilis, which we don't think is a pathogenic organism, and some hookworm eggs. He had a lot of serology. Epstein-Barr virus, CMV, so he'd been previously infected with Epstein-Barr virus. No evidence of hepatitis. He had positive antibodies to flavivirus. Why do you think that might have been? Does it mean he was suffering from dengue? He was not IgM positive, he was IgG positive. Anyone in the front row like to suggest why he had antibodies to flavivirus? He had been vaccinated against yellow fever. So I should have mentioned that he had had all his immunizations and had been taking mefloquine malaria prophylaxis. And serology for toxoplasmosis and leptospirosis was negative. So, and he also had serology for a number of other infections, which we discussed yesterday. He had serology for histoplasmosis because he'd been in caves full of bats, but everything came back negative. So we treated his hookworm, we gave him some antifungal cream for his feet, He got better and was sent home, and we failed to make a diagnosis. But I'd like you to think as to what you think might have been the diagnosis here. So the next day, his friend came in, being in the same team, so the same exposures, and he had been unwell for 3 days with fever, pains in his muscles, and anorexia. He wasn't eating. So again, he was obviously a very fit young man. In this case, he had no fever. He had some conjunctival injection, but nothing else to find on examination. But the investigations showed renal impairment, a raised urea and creatinine, and again, raised inflammatory markers, raised CRP and ESR, but a normal full blood count, normal liver function. And again, malaria negative, all the cultures, stool, urine, and blood cultures were negative. Now, dark ground microscopy, we discussed this yesterday for the diagnosis of syphilis, but we were not thinking of syphilis in this case. So we did a dark ground microscopy of his urine. Would anyone like to, in the front row, like to suggest why we might have done that? Well, we thought, given the history, that these patients could have been suffering from leptospirosis. And one way to diagnose that is to find the spirochetes in a urine sample. So this is why we requested dark field microscopy on a urine sample, but it was negative. So again, he got better. We failed to make a diagnosis, and he went home. It turned out that 3 days before the second patient came, so September the 7th, that's 5 days after the end of the expedition, another man from the same expedition but a different team had been admitted to another hospital in London with a 4-day history of fever, rigors, abdominal pain and headache, and had had a high fever but nothing else to find on examination. 4 days later, he started to cough up blood and became a bit confused. He was transferred to our hospital for tropical diseases. He had a low-grade fever but no localizing signs. He had a full blood count that was normal, again raised inflammatory markers, normal renal function, slightly raised liver enzymes, and all the cultures were negative. Because he had been coughing up blood, we did a chest x-ray, which we thought was probably normal, but we did a CT scan of his chest, which we thought was not normal. And the report said there are multiple nodules of varying sizes, which are generally small and have a marked halo of ground glass shadowing. The appearances are typical of hemorrhagic nodules, for which there is a wide differential. However, the possibility of acute schistosomiasis should be strongly considered. Now, we discussed acute schistosomiasis or Katayama fever yesterday, and clearly this man has been exposed to fresh water as well as probably salt water. So do we think he could have had acute schistosomiasis? Dr. Nagy is shaking his head. Why not? There is no schistosomiasis in Borneo. I think that is probably true as far as I know. That's a good reason. And another good reason?
No eosinophilia.
He has no eosinophilia. So we're going to be discussing eosinophilia later. But if you remember, the case we discussed yesterday had a high eosinophil count. So we did not agree with the radiologists that schistosomiasis was a likely explanation for these findings in his chest. So, but nevertheless, we sent him for bronchoalveolar lavage in case he could have TB or some other cause for his hemoptysis, but nothing abnormal was found. And he again improved dramatically, his fever settled, his liver function came back to normal, and we sent him home. So again, we have sent, that's now three patients from this expedition, we have failed to make a diagnosis. However, then after he had gone home, the serology came back, and he had clear evidence of leptospirosis. And serology then came back on the other two cases, and it seemed that they had all been suffering from leptospirosis. So there are many species of leptospira, which have different animal reservoirs. The one we know most about is the one with the long name, Leptospira icterohemorrhagii, of which the animal reservoir is the rat. But there are over 160 species of Leptospira affecting different animals, which can occasionally infect humans. In the UK, we see about 50 cases a year. We see some of these are acquired without foreign travel. If you fall in the River Thames in London, you are at risk of acquiring leptospirosis due to the rat one, icterohemorrhagii, which is not a good thing to have. And they have more cases in France. I'm not sure why that is. So these bacteria, they are spirochetes. Like the cause of syphilis, they can survive for weeks in water. They are thought to penetrate mucosal surfaces or abrasions, scratches or cuts in the skin, and they can cause hepatitis, they can cause renal damage, meningoencephalitis, myositis, and hemorrhagic manifestations. So most cases are mild and self-limiting, as in those three cases I described to you. But some cases are more severe, with hepatic and renal involvement. And the severe cases, which is a small minority, nearly always due to icterohemorrhagii, the rat organism, and they can lead to acute renal or hepatic failure. And extensive bleeding, we saw one of our cases had hemoptysis. This is not uncommon. And a 10% mortality. So diagnosis, as always, we have to take a good history, and we suspected leptospirosis in all these cases because of the history they gave us, but we were unable to confirm it until we got the serology back. But when you see someone with an acute febrile illness, with evidence of renal impairment, abnormal liver function, and a leukocytosis, you should consider it. The cases I told you about were self-limiting. We did not give them antibiotics. If you are going to treat them, then doxycycline or penicillin are both effective. There is a risk of a Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction, as you may get with syphilis, due to death of the bacteria. So that was leptospirosis. I'm going to tell you now about another case, a 60-year-old Swedish woman who we saw recently at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London. She lived in a small town in Mali, which is in West Africa, where she owns a small hotel. She lives there most of the time. She doesn't bother to take antimalarials, and she has been previously well. So where is Mali? It's this big this country here. This big yellow country. So it's desert in the north, the Sahara Desert, and savanna in the southern part. So it is, malaria is endemic in the southern part of Mali, but she was not taking antimalarials. So she became unwell in August with a fever and a bit of diarrhea. And because there was no doctor available in the village, she self-treated with antimalarials, and she took some metronidazole in case she had giardia, and that was causing her diarrhea. The diarrhea improved, but she continued to have fevers and feel rather weak and tired. So after 1 week, she went to hospital in the capital, in Bamako. And she had some investigations. She had raised inflammatory markers, CRP and ESR. She had a neutrophilia. It was thought she probably had a urinary tract infection. She was treated with intravenous and oral antibiotics. But she didn't get better. She continued to have fevers, to feel nauseated and tired. So that was in August. So this is now a month after her symptoms began. She's finally admitted to hospital in the capital, a nice French hospital. Again, she's found to have raised inflammatory markers and a neutrophilia. She's HIV negative. Giardia cysts are found in her stool. She has a CT scan of her abdomen, which shows edema of the colon and a benign liver cyst. She has a colonoscopy, which suggested inflammatory bowel disease, and some biopsies were taken. Her giardia was treated with a course of metronidazole. Her diarrhea improved, but the fever continued. So this is now after 1 month of being unwell with fevers. So the biopsy had to be sent away, I think, to France, so it took a while to come back. When it came back, it showed florid signs of chronic inflammation and some granulomas, and the pathologist thought she was probably suffering from Crohn's disease. So the physician in Bamako advised treatment with steroids. What do you think of this advice? Is it sound? I see some people shaking their heads in the front row. So, is this good advice, Dr. Nange? Why not?
Not happy that they've ruled out an infectious.
You're not happy they've ruled out an infectious cause. Okay, so to give steroids to somebody in whom there may be a chronic infection that's been going on now for almost 2 months, probably not a good idea. So, she decided she wasn't going to take this advice, and she came instead to London and came to the Hospital for Tropical Diseases. This is now 2 months after the onset of her symptoms. So she came to our walk-in clinic. She is by now feeling extremely unwell. She's lost 10 kilograms since the illness began. She was not overweight to start with, so she's extremely thin. She has a temperature of 38 degrees. Abdominal tenderness, especially in the right upper quadrant, but no masses or organomegaly were found. So what are the key investigations to do now? What have they been missing in Mali for the last 2 months? I think there is one investigation, especially bearing in mind that she was found to have a so-called cyst in her liver on the CT scan. So investigations showed, again, raised inflammatory markers and neutrophil count. She was by now anemic. HIV is still negative, but she has amoebiasis. So in the stool microscopy, we saw cysts of Entamoeba histolytica, which is the cause of her illness, but the cysts cannot be distinguished microscopically from Entamoeba dispar, which is a harmless commensal. But clearly this woman has an illness which is consistent with amoebic colitis and an amoebic liver abscess. And indeed, serology for amoebiasis was strongly positive, and PCR of the stool confirmed that this was indeed Entamoeba histolytica. So the diagnosis was of amoebic colitis and an amoebic liver abscess. It's a very good thing she was not treated with steroids, because she probably would have died if she had been. And so she was treated instead with a 5-day course of tinidazole, and 10 days later was entirely well. Her symptoms had all resolved. Tinidazole will treat the will kill the trophozoites that are causing the colitis and the liver abscess, but it will not get rid of the cysts from the intestinal lumen. So she needs to be treated with something else. So we gave her a 7-day course of a drug called peromomycin 3 times a day to eradicate the cysts. At follow-up, she was entirely well. Fever had gone. She was eating again. The diarrhea had settled. And stool microscopy showed that we had got rid of those amoebic cysts. So she was cured very simply with antibiotics. So amoebiasis is something that you should not forget in somebody with an unexplained fever, especially if they have right upper quadrant tenderness suggesting a liver abscess or any history of bloody diarrhea. So my third and final case before I hand over to Dr. Nadj was a 30-year-old English woman who presented to the Hospital for Tropical Diseases a few years ago now. She had been living in Angola. I think we have a map to show you where Angola is. Angola is this country here. So in southwestern Africa, bordering on Congo. So a tropical rainforest area. She had been living there working for a non-governmental organization on and off for 5 years. She was not directly involved in healthcare. She was not seeing patients. So that's one thing we wanted to be clear on. So we don't think she was at risk of a viral hemorrhagic fever such as Ebola or Lassa. She had been previously well, and she was seen in outpatients in the middle of December. So the story was that in early November, so about more than a month before we saw her, she developed a fever. She had a shivering attack, headaches, fever, and felt very tired. She had a malaria film and a rapid point-of-care malaria test done in Angola, which were negative. She vomited blood on several occasions. She was treated for malaria with artesunate and doxycycline, but she didn't improve. She was admitted to hospital in Angola, said not to have malaria or typhoid, was nevertheless given a 5-day course of quinine to treat malaria. Her fever settled, but she developed a rash, which she described as blotchy. And she was losing weight, so she had lost about 5 kilos by this time. She had a low white count and a low platelet count. Those are the investigations we saw on the papers she brought with her. She was then transferred to a hospital in Cape Town, in South Africa. She's still feeling unwell. She's weak, she's vomiting, she has a headache. Blood tests were said to be all normal. So she came back to the UK feeling tired and weak with some dysuria, and she came to see us at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases. So I said yesterday, and I will probably say again today, it's really important to take a thorough history. So what exactly had she been doing in Angola? Because the doctors who saw her in Angola and South Africa had failed to do this. So vaccinations, she was up to date with, she'd had yellow fever and hepatitis A vaccine. She had not been vaccinated against hepatitis B, but probably not at high risk. She wasn't working in a healthcare setting. She wasn't injecting drugs. She sometimes remembered to take her malaria prophylaxis, but not always. She was living in a rural area, but as I said, was not directly in contact with sick people or with animals. But she had had a new Angolan sexual partner with unprotected sex 3 months before we saw her. When we examined her, she was by this stage well, the fever had settled, she had no rash. There was one lymph node felt in her neck, but essentially, and slight tenderness in the right iliac fossa, but nothing else to find on examination. Blood film for malaria was negative. Serology for some of the infections we discussed yesterday, trypanosomiasis is in the differential. The fever going on for now 2 months or more. She was negative for trypanosomiasis and schistosomiasis. Viral hemorrhagic fever, Ebola, Lassa, all negative. But her HIV serology came back positive, unfortunately. She had some atypical lymphocytes in the blood film. And so the conclusion was that she had been suffering from an HIV seroconversion illness, which had persisted for some weeks or months, and she had a high viral load. CD4 was still normal. So just to emphasize again the importance of taking a very thorough history when you see a patient returning from the tropics. So I'm going to hand over now to Dr. Nadj.